You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. On the phone with us now is Britta Belli, the editor of E!, the environmental magazine. In addition to editing, she often writes for the magazine itself. Britta is also a prolific blogger and has written a book titled The Autism Puzzle, Connecting the Dots Between Environmental Toxins and Rising Autism Rates. Welcome to Ecotopia, Britta Belli.
Thanks for having me.
Your magazine covers an incredible range of topics on the environment, health, nutrition, economics, ethics. Could you tell us a little bit about E! Magazine, where it came from, how long it's been around, and your audience?
Sure. The magazine has been around for over 20 years now. And it, you know, as you said, I mean, covers, we really try to be comprehensive in our coverage. It's bi-monthly. It comes out every 2 months. So we really try to, you know, when we do our feature stories, really give kind of a comprehensive look at these topics that we cover. You know, we've looked at, you know, extreme weather, you know, the most recent, the nanoparticles in the food supply. We've looked at ocean acidification. Some of these feature topics that we cover, we really try to look at issues that, aren't getting wide coverage elsewhere, and doing our own investigations. And then beyond that, we do a lot of coverage kind of that people can use in their daily lives. You know, different health concerns, how can you avoid toxins in your home and in the food supply, you know, various ideas for greening your home in terms of, you know, improving indoor air quality, you know, what are the best paints to use, that sort of thing, the green investing strategies, eco-travel. We have an eco-style column now, so we're looking at, you know, different clothing options and ethical clothing. And so we really kind of run the gamut, try to cover a lot of issues that we think, you know, are really things that people can use in their day-to-day lives.
We're always curious about who foots the bill for this sort of thing. Who are your sponsors, and specifically who advertises in E! Magazine?
Well, we, you know, we have revenue coming from two sources. One is we are a nonprofit, so we do apply for grants, and certain of our topics are topics that specific foundations are interested in funding. Nanoparticles and food was actually one of them. Not all of our top, you know, feature stories are funded, but some are, and that allows us to do greater publicity for those issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of advertisers, I mean, it's really a lot of kind of smaller, independently owned green companies by and large. You know, I think like Candle Cafe, it's like a vegetarian eatery in New York City. We have some animal rights groups that advertise with us, and really just kind of, you know, smaller personal care products and those sort of groups that are kind of our core advertisers.
Mm-hmm. I want to tell you, over the weekend, in fact, I was thumbing through the ads, found an advertisement for an iPhone app that shows you your distance, your azimuth out in the country. It's a terrific app, and I bought it because I encountered it in E! Magazine.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and actually we do cover green apps. We highlight different ones on our website as kind of a regularly updated column that we do.
And what's your background for all of this? Where did you go to school, and how did you come to be the editor of E! Magazine?
Well, my background, you know, school-wise, I went to Fairfield University. The magazine is based in Norwalk, Connecticut, mm-hmm. So not far from where I actually went to school, and started writing for local publications in Connecticut, and that led me to E!. You know, although it's a national magazine, you know, being that I was Connecticut-based, that really working for the magazine was what got me into covering environmental topics, and it's something that I've just really have a great interest in and have become really passionate about covering. So, you know, as you mentioned, I've now written a book about autism and toxins, which developed really from a cover story that I wrote for E!. So it's, you know, it's been something that I've just, there's so much investigation to me that's left to be done. There, to me, everything is really environmental, comes back to the environmental issues when we're talking about, you know, health issues, political issues, and of course, just the issues of what's happening to the planet in general. I mean, this, you know, so many of these things are connected to the environment.
I hope we get back to the topic of autism and toxins, because my daughter is a teacher in a private school in San Francisco, and there are a lot of children that are on the autism scale, and I wondered why that seemed to be increasing. But first, we want to talk to you. So let's get back to that. But first, we want to talk to you about the article on nanoparticles, because this is something that's really new to us. The article is, we know nanoparticles are in our food, but it's still unclear what harms they pose to our health. What are nanoparticles?
So nanoparticles are, you know, we can think of them as extremely tiny engineered materials. They are much smaller than a red blood cell, tens of thousands of times smaller than the width of a human hair. They're really like ultra-fine particles, and they're being used in all sorts of applications, you know, technology and consumer goods, and they're also in our food supply. And in the case of our food supply, they're being added to things, you know, sometimes just to change the pigment. They're being added as to enhance flavor, to deliver nutrients better. So they have a whole host of applications, but unfortunately, they're not being really labeled, for the most part, on food packaging. So we don't really know that they're in there, and it's still unclear what the long-term health implications may be for ingesting these. So there's a lot of questions about them, and that's sort of what the piece looks at.
Right. Where did they come from? I mean, did people set out to have certain effects on the food with nanoparticles, and so they were engineered to do specific things? It's hard for me to imagine how these got created.
Well, I mean, they're, you know, like anything, I mean, they're created in a lab. These are,
Sure. They're
not unlike if you think of food colorings or, you know, preservatives that are added to foods. Chemicals that are added to foods for various reasons. And, of course, a lot of our processed food has various flavorings and additives and colorings in it that aren't necessarily healthy but are considered okay to eat, you know,
and they
fall into that category. The FDA looks at them as generally recognized as safe. So it's sort of a catch-all, you know, umbrella term, and they fall under that provision. And for that reason, it's not considered that they need to be independently tested. It doesn't have to be disclosed on the label. It can be if manufacturers choose to put it on the label, but in many cases they don't. But, you know, the health studies that are beginning to come out and the research that's beginning to come out on these is showing, because of their very tiny size, that they don't act in the body like other particles, and that they can do things that other particles can't. So they can get into our bloodstream, they can accumulate in our organs, they can cross the blood-brain barrier, and, you know, while it's not thought that these things are lethal by any means, some studies of animals are showing that there are some subtle effects that they can have, and we really don't know the full story yet. So is it safe to continue to allow these things before all the safety testing has been done?
Yes, I have a couple of questions. One is just what are some examples of foods that they're used in? It sounds like it's pretty pervasive.
It seems to be in a lot of these processed and packaged foods at the same time, and also in food packaging, these are. There is no comprehensive listing anywhere at this point where you can go and find out where can these all be found. The FDA, Food and Drug Administration, does not keep track of which foods contain nanomaterials. So they are not very helpful in that regard. One of the studies that I looked at nanotitanium dioxide. And titanium dioxide is used in all sorts of products. It's used in paint. It is used in sunscreen and other lotions, paper, plastics. It's also used in a lot of foods that have white coloring. And a lot of gums and candies, frosted foods, coffee creamer, things that would probably look kind of unappetizing if they weren't white. We just, you know, we kind of assume that they should be that color, but
not necessarily natural.
It's not a natural coloring, but So it lends white coloring to a lot of foods, and we do have that list. There's like a chart that came with this study, and they do specifically mention, you know, the Hostess powdered donuts, Kool-Aid blue raspberry, Betty Crocker whipped cream frosting. So there's, you know, kind of a list of these. So that's one, you know, this one study has, you know, revealed some of these products that contain at least nanotitanium dioxide. Others, it's less clear. You're not getting a lot of specific brand names and that sort of thing that you would like in order to be able to identify these things.
Right. And how did people go about doing the research on that? They read labels and said, this is a funny thing that I don't know something. Do you know how the research got underway to see what these things are and what they're doing?
I mean, you know, research, there's food companies themselves have researchers and food scientists. There are researchers at all, you know, major universities that are government funded.
Sure.
And so this is a huge new area of research in general, which is nanoparticles kind of overall. They're being used for so many applications. And so, you know, as with anything, there's still, you know, almost any chemical you can think of, there's research being done to see different effects it has on different parts of the body, and could it be cancer causing? Could it have any negative impacts? Kind of everything's under consideration, and this is just one of those areas.
Right.
In your article, you said you contacted the Food and Drug Administration, and I'll read the quote: "An FDA spokesperson admitted that the agency does not track which foods contain the particles, but relies on companies to voluntarily offer information." What kind of information do the companies offer, and is that helpful to understanding what's in our food?
You know, it really depends. One of the places where it's kind of most often disclosed is with nutritional supplements. Many supplements will tout kind of the benefits of the nanoparticles, and they'll say, it contains nano silver, and this is supposed to have some health benefits. And that's kind of one place where you will see it on the labels. Food manufacturers are really in a tough spot. There was one group I spoke to, As You Sow. They are a consumer advocacy group. And they said that they contacted some major food brands, including like PepsiCo and Whole Foods, Kraft Foods, to really gauge whether or not they were using nanomaterials, whether or not they were aware of these things in their own packaging. And in many cases, the companies themselves were not aware. They weren't sure if, for instance, in their food packaging, if it contained nanoparticles. So this group, As You Sow, kind of came up with a list of recommendations for these companies to go back to their suppliers to ask these questions. And then if they discover, okay, this is being used, to decide whether or not they want it to be used, how to disclose this to the public. So right now, it's a real process of discovery, even for the food manufacturers themselves, especially when it comes to packaging. They may not be aware, and that food packaging can present another route of exposure for people in the food supply.
Right.
The independent agency you referred to, is that the Woodrow Wilson International Center? You mentioned that in your article.
Yes. Well, that is another group that's attempting to actually come up with a more comprehensive list of these products, and they're kind of doing it, in a very slow fashion. It's really far from comprehensive at this point, but they are doing their own investigation and attempting to come up with this list. The group I just mentioned, though, is called As You Sow, S-O-W, and that's a consumer advocacy group that's also working on this issue and trying to raise public awareness about it.
I was interested, one of the references in your article was to the FDA's nanotechnology fact sheets, and one sentence caught my eye. The very changes in biological, chemical, and other properties that make nanotechnology applications so exciting may also may merit examination to determine any effects on product safety, effectiveness, other attributes. That seemed to me a pretty casual statement about the whole question, and the fact that they talk about this as exciting sounds like a kind of a pro-industry point of view on the part of the FDA. Do you have comments on that?
You know, I have to say, I mean, I'm just really surprised, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are surprised as well, that the Food and Drug Administration isn't more concerned about the possible health ramifications of this, that it's really taking such a hands-off approach. And saying basically because of these are smaller versions of accepted substances that they can just be ushered in as safe and no questions asked, when there's already health studies showing that they don't act the same way in the body, and a lot of consumer groups are kind of raising red flags about these particles and saying, you know, there are some definite issues here. At the very least, we should be approaching with caution. Part of it, I think, is that it's one of these instances of the technology really being ahead of the regulation, which happens so often.
A lot, yeah.
You know, and yeah, so it really is the agency just overwhelmed and can't really kind of keep up with what's happening? Or is there really just, you know, is it something, you know, more nefarious than that? I'm not sure. But certainly it is taking, I agree with you, a very casual approach. A lot of people have likened this issue to the issue of genetically modified foods mm-hmm. and those fights that are happening. You know, at the very least, it seems that consumers deserve to have this on the label and to make decisions for themselves, whether or not they want to eat it.
Right. It reminds me of the GMO fight we just had here in California. Right. Let us know. Just let us know.
Exactly. And
go ahead.
Oh, and I was going to say with Proposition 37, I mean, didn't end up passing. So,
right.
You know, that's a fight that continues.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Just let us know. So you talked a little bit about potential effects, and it's kind of early in the research to know what the impact is. But what are some things that they're investigating about the effects of these nanoparticles?
Well, one of the things with carbon nanotubes, they have been shown if they're inhaled, and carbon nanotubes are added to a lot of like electronic products. So this is not specifically a food issue, but
right.
It does show the health impacts. They've been shown that they can act like asbestos in the lungs, and they can actually, because of the way that they're shaped, lodge in the lungs and could be cancer causing.
Mm-hmm.
With other nanoparticles that are ingested, one of the researchers found that these could block iron absorption, or it could alter the way we absorb iron. So, at least in lab animals. So it shows that potentially, and this was the chronic exposure. So you know, potentially it could have these kind of subtle effects that might not be so obvious as okay, causing cancer, but maybe you know, is it changing the way we're absorbing other nutrients that we need? Another problem, potential problem with ingesting nanoparticles is that we may, you know, they're more bioavailable than other nutrients that are, say, you know, that come with like fortified cereals and those sort of things that we're used to. They can almost be targeted in a more specific way. Could we be getting too much? So could you almost be getting toxic amounts of certain nutrients that would otherwise be healthy? So
that's
another issue with these nanoparticles.
Right. I'd like to turn, we just have a little bit in the first half of the show, I'd like to turn to the issue of autism and toxins. And we hadn't sort of planned to do that, but it's something that you know a lot about. I'm wondering what connections you've discovered.
Well, there's been a lot. I mean, that in regard to that, a lot the research has really picked up. And, you know, the book I wrote looks at a whole host of different things that we are exposed to on a regular basis and how they're connected to rising autism rates and all the research that's been done. And it's everything from these kind of endocrine-disrupting chemicals, that we've heard of the phthalates, the bisphenol A, you know, that we find in canned foods, to pesticide exposure, which can mean everything from, you know, agricultural workers out in fields to home pesticide use, so things that we're using on our cats and dogs and in our homes to kill cockroaches and those kinds of things, to, you know, heavy metals like mercury and lead. And, I mean, there's just so many chemicals in our kind of daily environments and things that we're exposed to and not always aware of and really have, unfortunately, so little control over in many cases, but that all are pointing to possible, you know, kind of drivers for this autism epidemic.
We we have a sustainability conference here at Chico State University that the students do, and it's a fabulous conference. But Pete Myers from Florida, who's an independent researcher, talked about those endocrine disruptors and other toxins that what we haven't looked at is how they operate in combination. First of all, that they function probably at have an impact at probably smaller levels than we previously believed, but in combination with one another, they can have a huge impact. And all of those toxins that you just listed that are in our homes regularly combine and have a huge impact.
Right. I mean, and that's what it really is coming down to, is that this isn't, you know, there isn't going to be one chemical that's going to be stumbled across. Okay, this is the one that's causing all these autism rates to go up. But it's this genetic susceptibility combined with these various exposures, oftentimes exposures that are happening while the mom is still pregnant, and we're just becoming more aware of them, and we're becoming more aware of, you know, what any number of chemicals can do, even in very small quantities,
right,
when it's at a, you know, that critical window of development, you know, and we're just learning so much more about that. So, I mean, it's interesting, even, you know, talking about the nanoparticles and talking about these other toxic exposures, when we really look at our regulation and what's lacking. I mean, that seems to be kind of the overarching theme here is, you know, why are we doing such a poor job of regulating the things that we're exposed to and even eating, you know, in many cases. And so, I mean, that Safe Chemicals Act is something that I bring up in the book and something that, you know, gets brought up a lot in the things that we're writing. But that need to really overhaul our chemical legislation, which is so outdated. It's from the 1970s, and it's, you know, was written at a time, grandfathered in, you know, 60,000 chemicals.
It was written
at a time when we just didn't have a really good understanding of, you know, of these long-term impacts, of these cumulative impacts. So that's something that, you know, I hope people will become more educated about and look into, but that Safe Chemicals Act is something that's, you know, it's been introduced in Congress, it made it through committee. What happens now, we don't know, but, you know, because oftentimes these things kind of stall out, but...
Right, and one of the things that we talk about a lot on this show is how when big chemical companies or big corporate groups in general get involved and want to protect their territory, those laws stall out kind of permanently, or it takes continuous activism to keep it in front of people. I was going to say one more thing, but Steve can say it for me.
I was just going to ask, you've mentioned As You Sow, and the Woodrow Wilson Project has a website, nanotechproject.org. We'll put both of those links up on our website. Are there other places that interested listeners should look or go to become better informed and to take an active hand in nanoparticle control?
I mean, so many of the kind of leading environmental groups are, you know, active on this issue or, trying to educate people on this issue. You know, so even like the NRDC is another one, Natural Resources Defense Council, it's, I believe, NRDC.org. Friends of the Earth is another environmental group that's been very active on this issue.
We're talking with Britta Belli. She is the editor of E, the environmental magazine, and a frequent contributor to that magazine as well. And we've been talking with her about her recent exploration of nanoparticles and their possible harm and autism and its relationship with toxins. We'll take a short break and change gears and ask her about her interest in research in ocean acidification. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we're talking with Britta Belli. She's the editor of E!, the environmental magazine. A couple of weeks ago in this program, we talked with Robert Wintner. This was the second time he talked to him, a.k.a. Snorkel Bob, about some of the dangers to the coral reefs due to extraction of fish and people mucking around in the reefs. And in an article in the May-June issue of E! Magazine, Britta discusses another threat not only to the coral reefs but to the entire ocean food web. In this segment, we'll ask her about that article, This Is Your Ocean on Acid. You begin the article with stories about the decline of the shellfish industry, clams, oysters, and so forth. What is happening to these fisheries, and how is it tied to ocean acidification?
Well, essentially, we have all these carbon dioxide emissions that are released into the atmosphere, and these emissions end up being absorbed in a large part by our oceans, which serves a great function for the planet in that it kind of keeps global warming, helps to keep global warming in check. But it's reaching kind of that saturation point where it's beginning to change literally the chemistry of the ocean and making the water more acidic. And it's that, by changing that pH balance in the ocean, animals that live there and form shells, that slight upset in that balance, their shells actually begin to dissolve as they're trying to form them, and it can lead to large die-offs, which is what happened with some of these oyster farms in the Pacific Northwest. We've already seen the impacts of ocean acidification. And what was so interesting was that this is happening like in controlled hatchery environments. So they were really at a loss as to what was going on, and they realized that it was this water that they were bringing into their intake tanks. They finally tested that at the pH balance of it and realized, because they thought it was some sort of kind of larval infection, something that had happened like that, and it turned out to be the acidity of the water. So they were able to put in certain measures in terms of testing the water in order to prevent this in the controlled hatchery environment. But this is happening, wide scale in our oceans overall. So the implication is that, as our global emissions continue to rise, this is the sort of thing we're going to begin to see kind of in a large-scale way.
Could you give us a sense of the degree of this change, maybe the pH shift? We're not the oceans haven't become the equivalent of vinegar, acetic acid. These are very slight, relatively slight shifts, are they not?
Right. In the last 100 years, the pH has fallen by, 0.1 unit. It's kind of minor changes, and it happens over large periods of time, but that process is starting to accelerate in recent years. So what we're seeing is just kind of a speeding up of this kind of global process, and it's thought that, this is going to begin impacting, creatures sort of at the bottom of that ocean food web, the pteropod, these tiny sea snails, marine snails, these and other kind of shelled creatures and phytoplankton. And these are the food sources for so many, other marine animals. And as each animal is impacted, it impacts other animals up that food web, all the way up to, even shorebirds. So the potential for just a huge ricochet effect, I think, is what's really so worrisome. And this also directly impacts coral reefs. Again, these are, corals are already in so much danger. They are, so many different stressors on them, from overfishing and exploitation. And when you add to that the ocean acidification, which, again, this prevents them in some cases from being able to build the corals quickly enough to sort of keep up with that that imbalance, that it's one more stressor and it's one more contributor to coral reef die-offs.
We have been pretty convinced about the dangers and causes of problems in the ocean, including acidification and climate change and other effects. We've done some work on the garbage patch in the Western Garbage Patch, and there are just so many stresses on the ocean. So what is being done?
I mean, there's different things that are being done. One of the best things is really when you create these conservation areas. So there's kind of these international conservation areas that are being created around coral reefs, where you're really saying we're closing these areas. You know, the Great Barrier Reef in Australia is a great example, you know, where they're saying, you know, we have certain zones here that are really, you can't do anything besides maybe take pictures of the corals. And that's
right.
it. I mean, and really closing these to fishing and to, you know, these, especially these large fishing operations, which can really do a lot of damage. So that's one way. I mean, obviously there's, you know, pollution controls. Simply enforcing the laws that we already have would go a long way towards starting to protect ocean health. And really restoring wetlands is really important because that helps to restore that balance as well.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that you can do to sort of help trap that carbon dioxide that you're taking the pressure off the oceans to perform that function benefits the oceans overall.
Yeah, and that's one of the issues we have in California, too. The California Delta is being threatened, and there are a lot of people who are doing work to try to protect the Delta for a variety of reasons. And one good thing, and I don't know if you've seen this in your work, is that the environmentalists and the sportsmen are starting to join forces, even though they have different interests in protecting the water and the water environments. They all want to protect it. And I don't know if you see that happening and what force you think is behind some of the efforts to save these wetlands and ocean areas.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, obviously that whether you're a sportsman or you're, you know, an environmentalist, I think you certainly have an interest in protecting these natural habitats, preserving these fisheries. If you're in the business of taking people out to fish, you want to make sure that there's fish out there to catch. So, you know, part of that is an effort in you know, knowing the area better, designing how you do things in such a way that you're not putting too much pressure on one area. You're in terms of, like, you know, fishing, allowing the fish stocks to recover, and really that is an effort that sort of involves everyone on you know, kind of on a local level.
Mm-hmm. Could we talk a little bit about the scale of these projects? I was interested. One of your interviewees in the article, The Ocean on Acid, his name is Rob Jackson. He referred to piecemeal solutions, and he sounded kind of discouraging about the fact that there may be individual projects, but they are kind of scattered and almost random. Could you discuss that and what it would take to get coherent efforts to solve the problems?
Well, you know, really it would take an international treaty and agreed upon, you know, setting emission standards that, you know, at an agreed upon level, and having all countries sign on, including the U.S. and China, who are the world's biggest emitters. And, you know, we just had that international climate conference in Doha, and nothing of the sort really came out of that. We're not seeing any really willingness on the part of kind of the large emitters of the world to really put down in a legally binding way, we are not going to go past this number. We are really going to, you know, keep our emissions in check. So I think that there's, you know, the solutions that you are seeing are coming in many cases from various businesses and corporations who are setting some hard numbers for themselves. That can do a lot of good, because they are certainly great contributors to emissions. And, you know, you're seeing better automobile standards. You're seeing states take real initiative. And, of course, California is just such a leader in that regard. So that's, you know, I think that's where we're at. We are at the piecemeal solutions. Until, you know, there's an internationally binding treaty, that's the best we can do. And certainly those are still great things to have. But as I think his pessimism came from the idea that, you know, there's just no political will for something, you know, something larger.
We've talked to a lot of people on this show who say it's not going to come from governmental agencies, even though they have the force if they actually put their minds to it or put their votes to it, but that it will come from the grassroots. And I'm wondering if you have confidence in kind of, and I mean, corporations can be grassroots too. You know, can we solve this with these individual solutions? Seeing what we have of the last climate conferences that can't seem to take us anywhere.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, I think there is some real potential there. There's still a huge movement, international movement, towards sustainability. Companies are absolutely, you know, making great strides and setting amazing commitments for themselves to be, you know, zero carbon emitting. I mean, they're really, like, they're setting just amazing goals to recycle everything, to, you know, to take up composting initiatives. They're, you know, they have huge influence, huge buying power. They're, and they can do a lot of good. You know, you take a company, they have, you know, GE size or Microsoft size or Apple size. I mean, Google, these companies can have a huge impact in the way they change their operations. So absolutely, that's, you know, something to be commended, and something that we're seeing a lot of movement in. And you know, and various countries are taking real leadership roles. You know, I think that swell of activism has, you know, has reached really amazing levels, and it seems to be continuing to grow. So I think there's a lot of positive momentum, and, you know, the whole question, I guess, is really, will it be enough? Will it be in time? I don't know that anybody knows that for sure, but at least that momentum is there. At least people are talking about this, and certainly this isn't something that's a fad that's going away. I think this is really we're changing the way that we do business and the way we operate. So, I mean, I think that's really critical.
Right.
We're talking with Britta Belli, editor of E! Magazine. We'd like to ask you about another issue that caught our eye in the December 2010 issue. You had a number of writers commenting on the question, do we have a moral obligation to save the planet? Wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, but we'd really, given your amazing and comprehensive background, we'd like to know what you think about that question.
You know, it's become a real issue among religious groups now, that this, the idea of saving the planet, you know, that really this is a religious duty of some kind, or it's a moral imperative, as you said, you know, for people. And it's something that's being kind of taught and espoused in various religious centers and religious ways of life. So, and across all different sorts of faiths. And it's, and I think it makes so much sense. We even saw the release of a green Bible not long ago, where, huh, you know, the passages that had, you know, sort of an environmental tone or theme were actually highlighted in green. So this is something that, again, that, the you know, makes a lot of sense together. I think as a thoughtful, caring person, who kind of, you know, you see your place in the larger sphere and the connectedness of everything, you know, honoring the earth makes perfect sense. And so, like, to me, that's a very fitting, and is it a moral imperative? I mean, to me, it absolutely should be. I mean, this is, you know, this is the planet that we're leaving our children, our grandchildren, and, you know, whatever we can do to make sure that it is not an apocalyptic place to live seems to me very important. And I think particularly now we are just really on that cusp of, you know, going too far in terms of our emissions and what, mm-hmm, that might do in terms of that tipping point, you know, tipping us into sort of climate catastrophe that we can't return from.
Right.
And not to be, you know, overly scary about it, but I think that, I mean, this is, you know, what I read over and over again, and I'm sort of immersed in this stuff.
Sure.
And this is what so many experts are saying, that you know, we're really getting close to that point. We're really nearing that ledge, and of course we're seeing this with the extreme storms and extreme weather already, and the increase in that, and all the weather extremes that we've been seeing recently, and just the increase in those, I think really has been a wake up call for a lot of people. So
you see, you know, people changing. you see people's attitudes changing. Like the Green Bible, you wouldn't have seen that 10 years ago, I don't think.
I mean, certainly the green has become, I mean, mainstream, you know, and, mm-hmm. and of course that raises the issues of the greenwashing and things that are just
sure.
kind of touting their
Absolutely.
Being green without, you know, and all of that. There's people just capitalizing on it, of course, but there's, I mean, there's a real, you know, also a real sustainability movement afoot and a lot of attempts now to really do a better job of measuring the sustainability so that we can, you know, really know how different companies measure up and really holding them accountable. So, you know, all of those things are happening now. And absolutely, as I said, I think this is something that is really just a new way of doing things. I don't see it as any longer as just sort of a marketing buzzword. You
right.
know, I mean,
yeah.
I think this is, you know.
That would be a good change. So you, we talked to ask this question of people we talk to a lot. And I think to be an activist and to be doing the kind of work you're doing, even though you're immersed in kind of these apocalyptic stories about where we're going, that you must be able to maintain your optimism somehow.
I mean, absolutely. There are so many groups doing so much good. I mean, you see, you know, I mean, I think there are a lot of positive stories as well. There are, you know, even with the ocean acidification story, for instance, there are, you know, these protection efforts that are being put in place, and you're seeing, you know, some of these reefs starting to rebound. You're, as people kind of step up and start to notice these things, when we, you know, I was talking about the autism and toxin issue, there has been an enormous amount of movement against some of these chemicals of concern. I think of BPA, bisphenol A.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
And it's done a lot of good. I mean, consumer concern and eventually consumer outrage on this issue has really led to companies, you know, removing this from babies and children's products.
Exactly.
So you're seeing, like, really, you know, as these consumers take interest and voice their concerns, you see companies respond. And they're not waiting for government regulation. It's happening because of people really caring about these issues and groups publicizing these issues. You know, the same thing with the fracking issues. In the drilling
right,
for
yes.
natural gas,
mm-hmm.
and you're seeing a lot of communities kind of, again, take to the streets, really that kind of, you know, old school activism happening,
mm-hmm.
and really it's being very effective. And so, I mean, I think those are all, you know, very positive signs. It's a positive sign that people are aware of these issues, that they care enough to get out there and do something about them, and that they're actually making a difference.
Thank you. That's important for us to hear. And as we've said, you've displayed an amazing range of knowledge and understanding here. What are you writing and thinking about next? What will be in the next issue of E-Magazine?
Well, our next issue is our January-February issue. We actually have a large cover story on the return of biking, believe it or not, riding
Fabulous.
Bicycles. And, you know, and just all the different ways communities are bringing back biking, from bike shares in cities to, you know, the rail to trail movement and all sorts of things like that. So actually, it is a very feel good story, and I think it's a positive sign that we're seeing you know, biking really come back to be a, you know, to as a real form of transportation. You know,
yes. Yeah, Chico's a great example of that kind of resurgent as well. And about your personal research, where are you going with say autism and other concerns about toxins and things in the environment or our food?
Sure. Well, you know, my book I've updated a little bit. I mean, in order to reflect mostly the new numbers, you know, it was 1 in 110 kids when the book came out that had autism, and now it's 1 in 88. And I have a new edition coming out, you know, just slightly updated, really, but coming out in spring, the paperback edition. And that's called the Autism Puzzle. So that's something, too, that I'll be doing some amount of publicity for and getting out to bookstores where possible. And something that really I continue to keep up with more on my blog, which is autismandtoxins.com. And, you know,
right.
because the research is just always evolving on that.
Fabulous. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we have been talking with Britta Belli. She is the editor, writer, and activist on environmental issues. And we strongly encourage you to check out the Environmental Magazine. That's at emagazine.com, and her blog, as she just mentioned, is www.autismandtoxins.com. We thank you so much for being with us tonight and taking your time to explain some of these issues.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Good night. Thanks.
Listen by the ocean, watching waves roll onto the shore. I said.